You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And knocked on the door of a rather modest apartment building in a small town in northern Poland called Szubin. And lo and behold, we met my relatives after, 35, 40 years with no contact.
This is Cold War Conversations.
Massive Soviet military forces have invaded the small, non-aligned, sovereign nation of Afghanistan.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
6, 9, 8, 8, 3.
The withdrawal of American and all other foreign forces from Vietnam within a period of 60 days.
And I'm here to host this final program from the German Democratic Republic for you.
Welcome to Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place for first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you subscribe in your podcast app so that you don't miss out on future episodes. Michael Zanowski was born and raised in the UK, but his interest in the Cold War goes back generations. His grandfather, having emigrated from Poland to the United Kingdom during the Second World War, was a distinguished member of the Royal Air Force in the battle against Germany. Michael's interest in the Cold War prompted him to pursue a doctorate focused around the Sovietization of Estonia post-World War II, which he researched over a number of years. His findings indicated a wholesale imperialistic strategy that centered around language, culture, and moving large numbers of Russians into Estonia. However, his findings also demonstrate a great deal of Estonian resistance to these efforts, with the local population finding ways of celebrating their local culture and heritage through covert means. If you can spare it, I'm asking listeners to contribute at least $3 per month to help keep us on the air. Larger amounts are always welcome. Plus, you get that sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a monthly financial supporter, and you bask in the warm glow of knowing that you are helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. Co-host Peter Ryan conducts our chat, and I am delighted to welcome Michael Zanowski to our Cold War conversation.
I'd like to start out by asking you if you can explain what prompted your initial interest in the Cold War.
Yeah, well, I guess in many ways it was similar to a lot of kids growing up in the 80s, seeing the parades of Soviet soldiers in the May Day parades, seeing the celebrations of the October Revolution, knowing that there was a part of the continent on which I lived that was inaccessible. And it's always that fascination with the unknown. And then as growing up at that time, you remember, you have flashbacks to some of the main milestones. So I particularly remember Chernobyl in the accident happened in late April 86, but it wasn't until the middle of May 86 that we really found out, the rest of the world found out what was going on. So I remember watching a children's news program in the UK and seeing how they covered the coverage of that disaster. And it was clearly a time of worry for everyone. But when you're a child and you know about the dangers of nuclear war, and seeing that disaster unfold was etched into my memory. And then as the decade progressed, I remember vividly watching the footage of the Berlin Wall come down, which was one of those moments where you know that world is suddenly going to change, and that forbidden world, the Eastern Bloc, was actually becoming was breaking down and would become part of our lives. And then I think on a personal level, I've got a Polish surname, Zdanowski, which is quite identifiably Polish. My grandfather came over to the UK during the Second World War as a fighter pilot. And knowing that I had Polish family that I could never see during the 80s was one of those things that always kind of played on my mind. And knowing that you've got a long lost family in a what was then an exotic country that you see glimpses of on TV. So I think the Cold War for me worked on a number of different levels. And then as I got older and became a student, I was fascinated by history and then went on to study both Russian, Czech at university, Czech, Russian and Czech languages, and then Russian and Soviet history and consequently wrote a doctorate about the the Russian speakers who live in Estonia to this day.
So, Michael, I want to get into the research that you did at university with regards to Estonia and the certain elements of Soviet cultural imperialism. But I was wondering if you could maybe, just before we jump into that, talk a little bit about that family that you had in Poland that you were aware of growing up. I know that you perhaps didn't get the chance, the opportunity to see them, but was there connections, was there communications between the UK branch of the family and those members who were in Poland?
Yeah, it's a great question. So my grandfather came over to the UK, we think in late 39, early 40. Certainly he was in the UK by the middle to late second half of 1940. And he was a young Polish fighter pilot, and he consequently flew for the RAF and remained in RAF service until his death in the early 60s. And consequently, he was never able to go back to Poland because he was seen as a threat to the Polish state, like many of the hundreds of thousands of Poles who came over to Britain in the early 1940s as part of the war effort, mainly being Polish Army, Polish Air Force. So there was... We just didn't have contact with the Polish side of the family. Now, in the 50s, he did share letters with his mother and his my grandfather shared letters and correspondence with his mother and other members of his family. But my father, for example, never grew up speaking Polish. He went to a boarding school in the UK and had a classic British education. And so consequently, those links with the family in Poland were pretty much lost for the best part of 35 years. I think my aunt went to Poland in the mid-60s, I think 65, 66, and actually met some of the Polish family. But it was a very strange experience because she had to go to Berlin first and then get on a train in East Berlin and go to Poland. But throughout the whole of her time in Poland, and it was only a few days, she was followed around by a minder. So you think about the strangeness of that experience, seeing your close relatives who you've never met before, but have perhaps had some contact in the past, and then having effectively a non-family member act as chaperone throughout the whole of that time was a very strange experience. I remember my aunt talking about that. So consequently, we didn't have any contact with the Polish family really until the late 90s. And I asked my aunt if we had any links to the Polish family. And she said, well, all I've got really is a couple of addresses. And there'd been no correspondence for about 30 years. And consequently, I planned a trip to Poland. I was 18, 19 back then. And where I was staying in Poland was actually quite close to where one of these addresses were. So I ended up, I was staying with another Polish family at the time. I was doing a kind of exchange. I had the address of where the Zdanowski family used to live 30 years earlier. So we knocked on the door, and my Polish wasn't very good back then. So the Poles who I was with, the Polish family who I was staying with at the time, did all of the translation. And they said, well, your family doesn't live here anymore, but we think they live in a village about 10 kilometers away. So we got the address, the new address, and knocked on the door of a rather modest apartment building in a small town in northern Poland called Szubin. And lo and behold, we met my relatives after 35, 40 years of with no contact. So it was quite interesting. And then I've remained in contact with them ever since. And the amazing thing is that they'd also at one point one member of the family had come to the UK in the mid 90s with an address of where they thought we were living and had tried to find us. So it kind of was a wonderful story and a really nice way of showing that families, there is a way of that families continue to try and keep in contact or overcome that gap of the Cold War and after the Berlin Wall came down and the systems changed, they were able to find themselves. And that pattern actually, I know, was repeated quite a few times. So with other people I know who I studied with and got to know. I thought that was worth sharing.
Let's talk a little bit now about you and your interest in the Cold War, effectively fueling your studies at university. Now, I know that you and I have chatted in the past a little bit about the experiences that you'd had studying in the UK and some of the interesting characters who you encountered who had a bit of a Cold War feel about them. Can you talk a little bit about who perhaps some of your tutors or some of the people around campus might have been that might have prompted or even magnified your interest in this period?
Yeah, so I was very lucky because I studied at Leeds University and studied history there. But at Leeds, there was and still is to this day, a fantastic Russian and Slavonic studies department. And back in the mid to late 90s, when I was first started learning Russian there and studying Soviet history, a lot of the tutors had effectively learnt their Russian in the military in the late 50s, in the mid to late 50s and early 60s. And therefore, these were people who had learnt Russian extremely well. And I would put their linguistic skills as among the highest of people I've ever met. I mean, they knew the language inside out and were of a much higher standard than I thought of some of the other language teachers in other language departments in the university. And I think it was that the fact that they'd learned the Russian or Czech or Bulgarian in with the British military back in the 50s, early 60s. So that those guys had knocked around MGU, the big Russian state university in Moscow. They'd studied there in the 50s and 60s. They'd been around the Eastern Bloc. They'd really understood the nature of these societies, and they actually brought that to the table when they came to teach you, whether it was on the history side or the linguistic side. So, I was very, very fortunate, and it was from that actually I became more and more engrossed by Soviet history and really this period of history that I looked at and I thought was most interesting were those latter years of the Soviet Union, the years of Glasnost, Perestroika under Gorbachev. So really 85 until 91, where the whole foundations of Soviet society were starting to crumble before the regime's eyes. And what you see was this multi-ethnic state empire crumbling under the weight of its own contradictions. And it was just a great time to be studying that history 10 years after it happened, because the dust was starting to settle on that period and the main actors were still around. I looked, as part of my research, mostly at the Russian language press. So in the Soviet Union, you had the Union Press. These were newspapers which many of us have heard of, like Pravda and Izvestia. And these were published in Moscow, and they carried the stories from the whole of the Soviet Union. They were available in every Soviet town and city, and were effectively the mouthpiece of the regime. So I looked at those newspapers and how they tried to construct a Soviet identity, and particularly in the Baltic states, and how they treated the Baltic states and talked about the Baltic states. But I also looked at the local Russian language press in Estonia itself. And from the mid-1940s onwards, the Soviets had a number of newspapers that were published just for the Russian-speaking Soviet population there. So these are publications like Malodzhezhe Estonii, which is the youth of Estonia, and Sovietskaya Estonia, so that's the Soviet Estonia. And what they did, they carried a very different message. So these were much more like the regional newspapers that we have all over the world and know and love. And they dealt with local issues. But also it's really interesting because in a command system like authoritarian system like the Soviet regime, they tried to create local identities. And this was really interesting in terms of building a picture of how the Russian speakers in Estonia thought of themselves. How did the Soviet migrants in Estonia think of themselves, and to what extent was the regime creating the identity for them? So that's really what I looked at in terms of that, the newspaper material. I also spoke to a lot of people over a number of years. So I conducted interviews with former Soviet citizens who are now living in an independent Estonia. I chatted to them about their life and how they came to Estonia, what their hopes were, their dreams, and how they fitted into the new Estonia. So it worked on quite a number of levels. And from this, I was able to build what I think was a really good picture of the Russian-speaking migrants who went to Estonia from the end of the Second World War and until the collapse of the Soviet regime. And then the secondary focus of my study was really about how these Russian speakers, who they effectively were Russian speakers after certainly 1991, how they started to fit into this new independent Estonia.
Interesting. Now, I'm curious about the individuals that would have come from Russia to Estonia, as you said, from the Second World War onward. What were some of their hopes and dreams? What were the objectives that they had coming into Estonia? What were some of the preconceptions they had? And how did it pan out based on the ones that you spoke to?
Yeah, so it was like a lot of these issues in history, when you start to dig down into it, it's a complex picture of different layers. And from 1945, hundreds of thousands of Soviet migrants went to the Baltic states to start new lives. Many of them were soldiers. So the Baltic states really strategically important for the Soviet regime and the Warsaw Pact. And as these countries had been incorporated into the Soviet Union relatively recently, the Soviets needed to shore up those territories. So you had hundreds of thousands of soldiers going into those countries. For a small country like Estonia.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
You had at any one time about 100 to 150,000 Soviet service people and their families. So this was part of the migration. You also had, particularly at the end of the Second World War, displaced people. And I should mention that Estonia at the end of the Second World War had suffered very badly. A number of Estonia's small number of cities had been badly affected. So there's a city called Narva on the border with Russia, which had been destroyed, 95% of the city flattened. The Soviets were rebuilding it. Equally, Tallinn had been, which is now the capital and was previously the capital, had been pretty badly damaged. I think around about 50% of Tallinn had been hit and destroyed. And so the Soviets needed people to rebuild Estonia. So what they did was they invited and sent people from across Russia and the rest of the Soviet Union to Estonia and the Baltic states to rebuild. I think another element that is interesting we should bear in mind is that the Soviets during the Second World War had deported several tens of thousands of Estonians, native Estonians, to Siberia. Some of those Estonians came back, some of them didn't. Some of them remained in the Soviet Union, some of them perished. And you had, after 1945, or during 1945, the emigration of tens of thousands of Estonians, native Estonians too. So you build, because they didn't want to stay in the Soviet Union, they didn't want to stay in Estonia if it was going to be taken over by the Soviets. So a lot of those Estonians moved to Sweden and other countries, including the West, Britain, US, and they were escaping. And so what you have is this really mixed picture of a volatile landscape where the Soviets are taking over countries that were previously independent, not viewing them as anymore as independent countries with an independent past and history, but starting again, bringing in a new broom, and with it come Soviet migrants, and alongside army personnel, there were people who were coming over to build factories and build industries, so technicians, engineers. And as the Soviet regime embedded itself within Estonia, you had people who were going to Estonia because Estonia was perceived as having a higher standard of living. So you had economic migrants going from the Soviet Union to Estonia. And that was something that came out of some of the interviews I did, because with that initial wave of Soviet migrants, a lot of them were sent to Estonia. They didn't have a lot of choice. They were soldiers or, family members were in the armed forces or working in the big military industrial complex. But then in the 60s, 70s, 80s, when it was the Soviet regime was more developed, you had economic migrants crossing the border from Russia, particularly Leningrad, as it was then. So now St. Petersburg, but some of the northern Russian cities, and going to stay with initially, and then live with their relatives in Estonia, because they knew that the standard of living was better there, and Estonia was seen as almost a window to the West in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and with that level of migration of people from Russia into Estonia over that period, that had to bring with it effectively a lot of, I don't know if cultural imperialism is the term, but certainly a lot of efforts to Sovietize Estonia by way of probably a whole different series of elements of popular culture. Could you speak a little bit about that, what your research would have found?
Yeah, so when the Soviets took over Estonia in the 40s, they imposed Soviet imperialism and in all of its naked glory. So there was no all of that diverse cultural life that the Estonians had pre-war was gone. There was the imposition of a Stalinist ideology, orthodoxy. And then if you look at some of the pictures of Tallinn and Vilnius and Riga in the 40s, 50s, you see that. You see the pictures of the statues of Stalin going up, Stalin, Lenin. You see the Soviet five-pointed star going onto buildings. And so in a very visible way, the Soviets were taking over. On a more cultural level, I mean, the Soviet takeover was absolutely profound. The civil society, which had been actually relatively strong in the pre-war Baltic states, was just destroyed overnight. So what you found in the native populations was that their lives in the public space were very different from their lives in the private space. So the Baltic states and the peoples of the Baltic states were able to keep their culture going, but only just, and that only really started to manifest itself publicly at the end of the 1980s, when the cracks in the regime were apparent, and they had these singing revolutions, which if you don't know about, do Google it and watch some of the footage on YouTube. But they were able to find an outlet through singing and their some of the values that they'd had and the customs that they'd put together in the 19th century, and they were able to use this as a way of fighting the regime in quite a soft way. But before then, the Soviet Union had taken over these countries pretty profoundly in all aspects, and it's difficult to really talk about these societies in a sort of cultural sense in the way we view culture, because we're all free to go to cinema and see the films we want to watch, and TV equally, or read newspapers and read diverse opinions. But that didn't exist in the Soviet system. To some extent, the Baltic states were sort of seen as a bit more culturally freer than the center and Moscow and the Russian heartlands, but actually that sort of cultural life was very prescribed for really from the end of the 40s till the Glasnost and Perestroika years in the mid to late 80s.
Did your research touch at all on changes to the education system that young people would have been facing, you know, going all the way from primary through to university, between a shift perhaps from pre-Second World War to post-Second World War, all the way up to the late 1980s?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of that education piece, the regime, the Soviet regime, tried to educate everyone in society, and they had an orthodoxy. And a lot of that identity and education was built around the fact that the Soviet Union had been the victor during the Second World War, that it had brought peace and relative prosperity to Estonia. I mean, if you're a native Estonian, you could see that was manifestly untrue. You knew your national past and history. But to the Russian-speaking settlers who ended up in Estonia, that orthodoxy was the truth, and that was the reality. They didn't have an alternative version to draw upon, at least not until the late 80s, when there were publications around the secret pacts of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which had effectively divided Eastern Europe and had sealed the fates of the Baltic states. So that Soviet educational orthodoxy was very much imposed pretty strongly throughout the period. I think there was a really interesting piece about that educational aspect around the fact that the Russians themselves were the, and you may have heard this term before, but they were very much seen as the first among equals. All Soviet nationalities were equal, but the Russians were first among equals. And you also see that quite clearly in some of the statements by some of the Soviet leaders in Estonia. So they, and this was part of my research, I looked at some of the speeches in the 1960s by the leaders of Soviet Estonia, and they were whilst ethnically Estonian themselves were very much mouthpieces for the regime, and many of the ethnic Estonian leaders in Soviet Estonia had actually spent their formative years in Russia. So they were very Russianized. And in some of the statements, you find that they talk about the fact that they want inter-ethnic relations to be harmonious. But at the same time, they're still pushing this orthodoxy that the Russians are the elder brothers of the Soviet Union. They're the sort of moral force that are progressing the country and delivering prosperity to everyone.
So I'm taking it from what you've been explaining to me, there was a lot of perhaps not overt resistance, but certainly under the surface, a great deal of resistance amongst a lot of cultural or ethnic Estonians to what the Soviets had tried to do over the course of the post-Second World War period. And I think that the whole singing element that you talk a little bit about, and I will be Googling that later, that was a great example. Did you encounter any other facets of resistance that perhaps the cultural Estonians would have brought out in order to preserve their culture and to resist the Soviet imperial culture?
Yeah, I mean, so some of the anecdotal evidence that I found as part of my research was quite interesting. I was going through my notes today, and there was this really good story of a KGB, a young KGB recruit who had been sent to Estonia to do some kind of training session, and he'd walked into a bar in Estonia, in Tallinn, and quite clearly he was Russian, had spoken to the Estonian bartender, who ignored him because he was speaking Russian. This was in the mid-60s, And apparently that was not particularly unusual. The Estonians would show resistance by refusing to speak Russian when they felt it safe to do so. They would make sure that the Russians knew, particularly I think the Russians from coming from outside of Estonia, that they'd make sure that they knew they were not welcome. And it was like these, I think these minor acts of resistance contributed to the sense that, you know, it sort of solidified Estonian identity. And also kind of made sure that the Russian speakers in Estonia, the Soviet migrants, knew that they that they shared this land with another group of people who really didn't want them there. So there were elements like that which were quite interesting. I think in some of these Soviet republics, the national the nationalities like Estonians, Lithuanians, Latvians, they very much tried to hang on to their pre-war culture and traditions. And they did so, I think, very effectively in spite of this Soviet regime. So, you know, they're Estonia's national religion is Lutheranism, like a lot of Northern European states. And Soviet people who went to Estonia couldn't quite believe how many the fact that the Lutheran churches or some Lutheran churches were still open in Estonia, because in the Russian heartland, for the most part, churches had been shut or some of them destroyed or turned into museums of atheism. And in Estonia, there was this air of freedom, and it was almost as if the Soviet regime knew that they kind of tolerated that Estonian nationalism. So the Estonians actually fought against the regime in ways like that. And then, of course, there was the whole Samizdat press. So like a lot of the Soviet nationalities, particularly during the 70s and 80s when the regime was starting to wobble a little bit, the nationalities, the Estonians, started to revive their own written culture, started to self-publish and write anti-Soviet, openly anti-Soviet leaflets, booklets, etc., to share, to sort of galvanize resistance against the Soviet regime. So again, that is a whole another area of history, which in itself would be incredibly fascinating to study for quite some time. So they did try to galvanize themselves as a nation, and when they saw a chance in the mid to late 80s, the Estonians, Latvians, and Lithuanians took it with both hands and actually inspired the independence movements in other Soviet socialist republics such as Ukraine and particularly the Caucasus states, so Armenia and Georgia and Azerbaijan.
And I want to ask a little bit about that because I know that your research and your thesis specifically was around Estonia, but did you get a sense when you were conducting this research the extent to which the Soviets might have succeeded in imposing their culture on Estonia relative to the success with other parts of the Soviet Union, some of the other socialist republics? Were they more successful in some regions of the country than others?
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Very good question. So I'd start by saying that that one of the reasons the Estonians managed to keep their sense of national identity and were so strong in terms of their determination to rid their country of the Soviets was that they have a very well defined sense of their own country, their own nation, their own ethnic identity, and that's partly because they speak a Finno-Ugric language. So Estonians related to Finnish and more distantly to Hungarian, and the Russians are Slav speakers, which is an Indo-European group of languages. So the Russians who went to Estonia couldn't speak Estonian. Many of them didn't bother to learn Estonian. For an Indo-European speaker, so those of us who speak English, Russian, etc., is very difficult to learn with some very difficult sounds. So the Estonians were essentially were able to keep their own sort of sense of ethnic identity, and I think that linguistic point helped. Whereas in Latvia and other countries, that the two groups, so the national, you know, the national group, the Latvians or the Ukrainians, because Russian is much closer to Ukrainian and Latvian, so Latvian and Ukrainian are Indo-European languages, fairly similar in the grand scheme of things, especially Ukrainian to Russian. The populations mixed a lot more, and in Estonia that didn't really happen so much. So that again helped Estonia keep its own sense of identity. I think the other element at play in Estonia is the fact that the Russians lived largely in different towns and cities to the native Estonians. So we were talking a bit earlier about this military-industrial complex. Well, a lot of the Russian speakers lived and continue to this day to live in the northern towns of Estonia on the Baltic Sea coast. So towns, not just the capital Tallinn, where the population is more mixed, very much mixed. So there's lots of Russian speakers, but the majority are Estonians, but they generally live in separate parts of the city. And that wasn't the case in a lot of other Soviet cities. And then in northern Estonia, you've got towns like Sillamäe, which was a former closed city, Kohtla-Järve, Narva, and these cities were 90% Russian-speaking plus. So they were very distinct communities and had a local identity within, which was built on their workplace, their town, maybe the Estonian Soviet Socialist Republic, and then the overarching identity was the Soviet Union. But a lot of Russian speakers and Estonians just didn't mix. They just didn't have opportunity to mix. So that again helped in terms of, I think it helped the Estonians when it came to pushing for independence.
So flipping this around a little bit, Michael, from the standpoint of Estonia, especially I would say more in the late 70s and in the 80s up until the fall of communism in the East Bloc, to what extent was Western culture infiltrating into the country? I mean, we saw huge advances in technology, huge advances in communications. Were there any elements of Western culture that you picked up on when you were doing your research that might have acted as a bit of a bulwark against what the Soviets were trying to impose on the people in Estonia?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So putting aside the fact that the Estonians, like the Latvians and Lithuanians, had memory of living in an independent European Western oriented state, which was one of the main reasons why their independence movements were so strong. There were other elements of those countries that were much more westernized and they had much more contact with the West than, say, the Caucasus republics, for example. So Estonia is only, I can't remember exactly, but it's tens of kilometers away from Finland. So from the mid to late 1960s, there was a regular ferry between Finland and Tallinn. And then you had Finnish tourists, a lot of them presumably going over to Tallinn to experience the Soviet Union and going over there. And so there was this mixing. And of course, the Finns, as just mentioned, speak a language which is very similar to Estonian. So it's mutually intelligible on some level. So you had that sort of mixing, and there was a bit of an idea of that Estonia was had more contact. It was a bit freer. The native Estonians could watch Finnish TV and understand it, so they had an idea of what was going on in the rest of the world. But the Russian speakers didn't. So again, that just shows you that division between the two populations. So that was definitely an element, and that lasted several decades. I think that was one of the main points there.
So to wrap up our discussion about the research that you conducted, and by the way, thank you. It's been absolutely fascinating. I'd be curious, from the perspective of somebody who was researching a few years after the USSR ceased to exist, and even from your own opinion to this day, to what extent does the legacy of what the Soviets did in Estonia still live on? Is it pretty well dissipated, or are there still elements that can be found in people's lives or how they speak or how they might consume popular culture?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest part of that is the fact that you've still got hundreds of thousands of Russian speakers in the Baltic states. And that is a direct result of Soviet imperialism. And those people who live there now are the generations who followed those initial settlers in the late 40s, 50s, 60s. One of the other parts of my research focused on the fact that actually those settlers, even by the late 80s, had developed a sort of separate and distinct Russian-speaking identity that was separate from that classical Soviet Homo Sovieticus model, that Soviet man model that the regime had been so keen to create. So I think the very fact that there are hundreds of thousands of Russian speakers in the Baltic states today is evidence of that. I mean, the physical infrastructure in the Baltic states. You still have huge housing developments in Tallinn and the other big cities, which show classical Soviet architecture. There's a very large housing estate in Tallinn called Lasna Maya, which is traditionally where the Russian speakers have lived. And the blocks are very similar to the blocks you'd see in certain suburbs of Moscow or St. Petersburg. And then moving beyond that, you get glimpses. If you look in the right places, you can see, in particularly the Baltic, some of the Baltic capitals, you can see elements of the Soviet regime, the odd red star on top of a building, which they've left there for posterity, or some of the statues commemorating the fallen during the Second World War, which, and I don't know if you remember, but in 2007 there was a big controversy because there was a statue of a bronze soldier, a bronze Soviet soldier, which stood outside of the National Library in Estonia, and had done for decades. And mm-hmm. in 2007, the Estonian government, which views the Soviet forces as not liberators but as occupiers, they moved the statue to outside of the center of Tallinn, and it caused a massive international dispute between Russia and Estonia, and you saw the Russian reaction, which was seen in a cyber attack on Estonia. So again, these elements kind of rumble on, but if you look in the right places, you can see elements of that that Soviet culture that had tried to impose itself over many decades.
Michael, we're going to move now to our rapid fire portion of the discussion. This is always a fun one, and I know that this is one that you're going to do really well at. I'm going to ask you a series of questions in regards to your thoughts about different elements of Cold War popular culture, personalities, and so forth. And I would love it if you'd be able to give me concise answers, the first things that pop into your mind.
Great, go for it.
Okay, can you tell me, what is your favorite Cold War-themed movie?
Great question. I would have said up until about a year ago, Bridge of Spies, which I think is a really great film, with the one with Tom Hanks. But I saw a film about 6 months ago called Zimna Wojna, which is a Polish film. Zimna Wojna just means Cold War. And it was a 2018 film, and it is set in Stalinist Poland, so just after the Second World War. It's a love story, but it deals with a lot of the aspects of the Stalinist takeover of Poland, which was cultural orthodoxy and not fitting in with the regime. So if you haven't watched it, do watch it. Zimna Wojna, Cold War.
It sounds really good. And sort of on that movie note, I saw a very good one a couple of nights ago called Mr. Jones, about a British journalist in the 30s who uncovered the famine in Ukraine. Fascinating film. That's one I would strongly recommend.
Great. I'll check that out. I haven't heard of that one, but that's an area, right? Again, well worth studying.
What about books? Are there any particular books about the Cold War that you've found especially scintillating or fascinating the past decade or so?
Oh, there's just so many to mention that I will just pick a couple out at random. But Bridget Kendall's recent book around the Cold War, very, very good. It's based on oral history. I know she's been a guest on Cold War Conversations. And she threads together quite a number of those stories very, very well, with personal reflection. I really liked some of the books about the KGB and the Stasi. There's this great book, and probably still the best book on the KGB, called KGB by John Barron. I think it was published in 73, but it actually looked at the KGB in detail and deconstructed their modus operandi and all of the various different directorates. So well worth reading. I mean, there were just almost too many to mention. I don't know if this counts as a Cold War book, but I really liked Gulag by Anne Applebaum. It goes up to 1953, so I guess it's technically a Cold War book. Books like that are just absolutely absolutely invaluable.
Yeah, I've read some of Anne Applebaum's books, and very good style, very, very strong research that goes into them, but written in such a way, I think, that even a casual observer or somebody with a casual interest in the Cold War can really get into them.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, and I know that you and I had been comparing notes not long ago as well about the East German Handbook. I think you've read it. I haven't finished it yet, and you enjoyed that one too, didn't you?
Fantastic book. I just love the way it's presented. And yeah, we're not on commission for this book, but it is a brilliant pictorial history of the East German, East Germany throughout the Cold War. And there was this great double page spread with pictures of bottles of liquor. So you've got your East German cherry vodka, you've got your East German mint flavored vodka, and different East German schnapps. And it was just a brilliant presentation of East Germany in all of its glory from what it was producing. So you could actually get a really good grasp of what consumers wanted in East Germany throughout the regime. And yeah, fantastic.
I can't wait to get into it. So, Michael, if you could identify a Cold War theme that hasn't been touched on yet in cinema or on television, what would it be? Or are there any particular themes that you feel need more exploring? I'd be fascinated to see if you could give us some insight into elements of that period of time that popular culture could really go into.
Yeah, so I think one area that would be really interesting is looking at the Westerners who smuggled whatever it is they were smuggling. So normally some kind of documentation into the Soviet bloc during the Soviet period, but who were also taking out information, taking out publications, taking out the Samizdat, the self-published journals and leaflets from across the Eastern Bloc, from dissidents, and sharing it in emigre communities in Western Europe and the US. So, and I got to meet a couple of people who did that, and their stories were absolutely fascinating. And if they'd have been caught, the punishments would have been fairly severe and not great for their general prospects. So, and I really admire that bravery to really to stand up to the Soviet regime. So I think that would be really interesting. And I don't, in all honesty, know an awful lot about it. And it was one of those parts of Cold War history that was so fundamental to bringing about the demise of the Soviet Union, and just this clandestine smuggling of films and books, leaflets, pamphlets, that it's well worth popular culture looking into.
So, final question in the rapid fire. If you were to have a dinner party with Cold War personalities, who would you invite, living or dead?
Living, I think somebody like Timothy Garton Ash, who effectively is the voice and authority of 1989. I think that would be really, really interesting. I think in terms of dead, I'm going to put my head on the line here and say someone like Vyacheslav Molotov, who was part of Stalin's government for so long and actually was part of the Soviet regime almost from the beginning, certainly the mid to late 20s, right until his death in the early 80s. And he was an unavowed communist, believed in the system, had seen all of the Stalin years and then the subsequent development and decline of the Soviet Union. So I think he would be pretty interesting to talk to. But then again, he was known as, I think, Iron Ass. So he was very austere and difficult to get on with. So I'm not sure he'd be the best dinner party guest. But anyway, he would, I'm sure, have some fascinating perspective.
Well, you know, you get a few shots of vodka into him, he might relax a little bit, but...
There you go.
You know, I have to say this has been a brilliant, brilliant discussion.
You're very welcome. It's been an absolute privilege.
And we have further photos, videos, and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Thanks again to all our financial supporters of the podcast, but a special thanks to our Politburo level Patreons, who are Sam Hardwick, Nicholas Butter, and Jeffrey Jones, who are supporting us at $30 per month. Thank you. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.